Cheapest in Old Westbury, New York. Westbury, New York.
This is Global Media News on LWWN, Old Westbury, New York. I'm Miguel Castro.
And I'm James Artesoni. You're listening to Global Media News from the New Media Newsroom on LWWR, Old Westbury Web Radio.
This week in New Media News,
how did this print?
How has the newspaper industry changed in the digital age?
What is augmented reality?
Is Pokemon Go all you need to know?
Is it really an email killer?
Can messaging apps like Slack really replace email?
How fast is 5G?
And when will it get?
From the celebrity and social media deaths.
Celebrity death threats on Twitter.
How many Twitter accounts are fake?
Twitter is more on Vox.
On the YouTube beat.
YouTube conspiracy videos go viral. What should YouTube do?
From the fake news deaths.
Are social media and fake news creating racial injustice?
All this and more coming up on WWR Old Westbury Web Radio, streaming live from the State University of New York College of Old Westbury.
The end of print journalism has predicted over and over again. Print circulations are declining, and most news organizations have gone digital first. Papers are still printed, but in an era when more and more people are getting their news on mobile and social media, very few new publishers still put all their efforts into putting print them on paper. Kristen Brave is here to discuss how the newspaper publishers are confronting digital media. Kristen, is a newspaper still a newspaper when it's on your phone or something?
So a newspaper is still a newspaper no matter what platform it's on. It's just that since there's such a higher demand for digital media now, newspapers have been putting their, have been changing their content to match what their audiences want. So since Snapchat's such a huge way to get news now, it's more like interactive for them. So it's still a newspaper. They're just changing the format of the platform you put it on. So the New York Times, they've seen a really big increase in their digital news subscriptions rather than their print subscriptions. They still have pretty good numbers for print subscriptions, and they really noticed that putting in, offering digital subscriptions shows that people still will pay for news instead of just getting free on social media and things like Snapchat. And a lot of the big news companies have been able to survive converting their print media to digital, but this transition's been more difficult for smaller companies and newspapers, and they're all in competition with other digital news platforms like Google and Facebook. The Times also, they've been getting increased revenues on their digital media, so they know that it's working, and the main difference between digital subscribers and print subscribers is the age, and adults age 65 and older who pay for news are 5 times more likely to buy print than digital, so it's 72% versus 14%, and younger adults, 18 to 34, equally likely to pay for print or digital, so that's 42%. And this is how print news is really evolving in the digital world through digital subscription service. And in order to survive, most of these companies have to adapt to this new type of new media.
But does the publishers make more money on a print or a digital subscription?
The New York Times CEO Mark Thompson, he said in an interview that without question, they get way more money on a print subscriber than digital because it has to get like sent to their house and everything. In digital, you could just get it instantly on your phone, so it's not very good cost of them.
What are some major digital companies?
Some of them were in competition with the New York Times or BuzzFeed, The Guardian, and The Washington Post. And then a lot of other news outlets that are becoming more popular just on Facebook and Twitter and so on.
How does the New York Times know their digital subscriptions are like successful?
Well, they gained 157,000 new digital subscriptions in 2017, and the revenue they made in 2016 just for digital revenue was $500 million, so that's more than BuzzFeed, The Guardian, and The Washington Post combined. So they know that it's working, and putting their news from print to media is definitely more successful.
Thanks Corpus Christi. Augmented reality is one of the ways that news publishers are creating new forms of content to tell stories in the 21st century. Marissa Ebola is on the augmented reality beat for us today. Marissa, what is the first example of augmented reality that you encountered?
One of the first examples of augmented reality that I encountered was Pokemon Go a couple of years ago when they came out with that app. And I feel like this is probably the first augmented reality that everybody encountered. So if you don't really know what Pokemon Go was, I mean, it's still an app, but it was when monsters would roam the land and your job was to capture them virtually with your mobile device. So, for example, people would go to, where they would download the app, and they would go to outside and virtually capture these monsters or creatures with their phone, and it would be the same scenario on your phone as where you are in person. So the environment, say you're standing in the park, your GPS would track your location and know exactly where you are and where your friends are capturing the same creatures. And basically your GPS is how they know where you are. And the Pokemon creatures are on your screen, and they're overlaying on top of what you actually see in front of you. And you could actually digitally customize the clothing and everything to make it how you want. I personally never played this game, but I know a lot of people that did, and that was the first time I actually ever realized what augmented reality actually was. Another example is how I really know what it is because I used to work at a home remodeling place, and what they would do is when people wanted to redo their kitchen or their living room or something like that, they would draw up the plans, and they had augmented reality goggles, which the customers would come in, put the goggles on, and they would virtually see what their kitchen is going to look like. And it was really cool because instead of just seeing drawn up plans of what your kitchen is going to look like, you could see everything from the color, the cabinets, the floor, and you feel like you're actually there. And I think that's really a step up from what Pokemon Go is, or was. And I feel like they're doing that with a lot of places now. You can actually, there's goggles that you can use that you could put on your face and pretend like you're actually there and you see it with your own eyes. And it's good for marketing because if you see what your kitchen is actually going to look like, you're going to want to get that kitchen. You're not going to hesitate about it because you're going to say, okay, I see it with my own eyes and I love it. Another example could be, I mean, there's a lot of examples, but now car companies are using augmented reality because they're test driving cars and you don't even have to go inside the car and actually drive the car, which I think is really cool. Like Toyota created a futuristic augmented reality experience where users could experience the new Prius Prime and without even actually being there.
So as a company or business, do you really think that augmented reality can help?
I definitely think it could actually help marketing a lot because, first of all, it's in the future, basically. The future is here. And I think it's a good way because, like I said about the home remodeling, you can see what you're getting, the whole thing, before you even get it. And I think that will make you really want to purchase something if you can actually feel it and know what it's like and see everything. It's a new level of immersion with a brand or a product.
Where is it being used, and also is it expensive?
It might be expensive in the beginning. Like, the price will vary depending on the content. The entry point with, like, the 360 video is about $150,000. And at most, it could cost $1 million. And the most interactive experiences start at $500,000, but in the end, it's actually you save because you see what you're getting before, and companies know that that's their their marketing point and that people are actually going to start buying things. So you spend money in the beginning, but in the long run, you make it off of it, basically.
What are the different types of augmented reality devices being used?
Well, they have, there's two primary devices that are being used, and the most basic ones. So it's a headset that have a display, which is what they use at the remodeling place. And you can see, you don't need anything, you don't need anything in your hands. You put on the goggles and you see what you're supposed to see. Another one is your smartphone, where the Pokemon Go is used. All you need is your smartphone and the app and the screen and the processor, and you see everything right on your screen, and your GPS is used as well. But I think the goggles are really cool because you feel like you're actually there. Pokemon Go, it used to be popular, and now I feel like the technology is advancing, and I read a couple articles that they're coming out with new content to make it even better, and I saw a couple of videos, and it's going to be really cool. For Global Media News, I'm Marissa Ebola. Back to you, Miguel.
Thanks, Marissa. Up next, is there an email channel out there? Will there be a chat or messaging app that can replace email in the workplace? And what about 5G? What is 5G, and when will we get it?
Welcome back to Global Media News. I'm James Arnazzoni. My co-host, Miguel Castro, is taking a hard look at email and its competitors for professional collaboration. Many media workplaces are using less email and more collaboration apps to communicate with their colleagues. One popular platform that was touted as an email killer is Slack. But Miguel, what's the problem here? Why don't people like email for work, and what do apps like Slack offer that's better?
Well, James, since the arrival of email, there really haven't been any platforms coming close to challenging it. This could really change the rise of social media platforms such as Slack and WhatsApp. Specifically, Slack has been used in more creative business editing settings, so for example, journalism, media, and marketing. But of course, this could develop eventually into a possible business venture for big business and financial aspects. As well as WhatsApp has been used a lot recently in retail, as well as other small sales corporations. For example, Spencer's has been using a lot of messenger apps to just send contact very simply. And the perks about these are the fact that, unlike email, which you have to check and have this whole process of logging on to, when you go into apps, you can just stay logged on, and on your phone, you get the immediate ding update. And you can just immediately communicate with that other person. Instant messaging has its perks of immediate notification, as well as there's been a lot of other formats that have been implemented in order to become similar to email. So, for example, I know that WhatsApp has allowed attachments such as PDFs or other image files and document files in order to compete with email to show that you could get files and important information across even faster through instant messaging rather than having to take the process of doing a formal email. As well as WhatsApp is even making a new app, considering how successful it's been in its possible business ventures, called WhatsApp Business. This application would be not only a communication between the guests and the business, but it would be between employees as well, so you could see what days are open. You can communicate specifics of, let's say you have a cake shop, and you can ask for specific customizations or specific times, and just honestly see if anything might come up, or you can just communicate with those that are in charge of the order. If your order comes earlier, you get the notification, you can pick up your cake or any other product that you choose. The big thing with Slack as well is the fact that there's a lot of organization, which is something that emails kind of struggles with. So, I don't know about you, but whenever I go into my email, I see so many just files of spam, these emails coming like, oh, you have won this, you have won that. With all that disorganization, like differentiating between important emails and just complete junk mail, it's very hard to use at times. So Slack has its own channels in order to organize set information. So for example, there are channels for professional work settings that are specific. So if someone wants to cover the media angle of something, they can go for it. If someone wants to cover the business angle of something, they have their own channels. And even if some fun in the workplace can be done with like random channels. So this all implements not only more organized workspace, but it also allows for more interaction and a bit more humanity into a very formal business setting. Other than this, there are also attempts to keep email alive through apps on phones that just try to make it easier for you. For example, there are a couple apps that try to just, hey, what are the most important files that come to your way? Like, you decide what senders of emails that you would prioritize, and they would immediately notify your phone. And any other, such as advertisements or marketing emails that you would get, it would be just deleted or sent to your junk mail instead of causing a clutter problem.
I totally get actually that, because, you know, I actually get a lot of spam in my email, and sometimes it goes through my spam, and sometimes it doesn't. It actually kind of annoys me. But what are the biggest issues, actually, with Slack and WhatsApp?
Currently, it's the fact that the email has been so prominent in business ventures and formal settings that it's just really hard to knock down, especially with the fact that biggest things about businesses are that you get that personalization of my email is this at whatever the company is. So it's a bit more personalized, but even though it's a bit old-fashioned and it's not as immediate, it's hard to just take down because of how effective it's shown to be. So there's a lot of companies that have shown success, and they do not want to risk new platforms at the expense of possible costs or performance.
Are there any other apps, and if so, like what are they?
Personally, I'd like people to just, depending on the setting, there's this app called Discord, which is very similar to Slack. That's for organization, but mostly if you're in like a technological space, or if you're specifically into gaming, it's very organized. You can put GIFs, files, and you can organize all your texts. It's very interesting, especially with the fact that it has released a new version of video chat, which is currently taking over and doing a lot of harm to the well-known Skype. So a lot of these are more for entertainment purposes, but they are definitely showing their probability and cause in these professional settings.
Do you think these could actually, like, take over?
I think that the fact that a lot of the youth in America right now, I think nearly 14% of the time, the youth, which is from 6 to around, I'd say, the statistics say around 16, 6 to 16-year-olds are currently using media or social media platforms around 16% of the time, compared to email, which is 2 to 4%. This shows a drastic increase in social media, such as Slack or other communication platforms, instant messaging, as a potential takeover for this email, as the new generation, Generation Z, and the millennials are definitely walking away or have preferences towards social media rather than emails. Reporting from Global Media News, I'm Miguel Castro, back to you, James.
Thanks, Miguel. What is 5G, and why does it matter? The telecoms are all talking about the rollout of 5G. Right now, the standard is 4G, but 5G is coming. Marcy Mendonca is checking out the promise of 5G for a faster connected future. Marcy, what will we be able to do with the 5G that we can already do with 4G? And can we expect 5G here in the U.S. anytime soon, even?
Thanks, James. So 5G is the fifth generation of wireless technology. We're supposed to have a faster network, and it's going to reduce lag time between networks. And industry experts expect it to be about 10 times faster than 4G currently is, and that's enough to stream 8K video or download a 3D movie in about 30 seconds. And right now with 4G, it takes about 6 minutes. The service is supposed to be more reliable. More gadgets can be connected to a network at the same time.
But when will it actually be available?
So the first commercial 5G rollouts are now due to begin this year. There are large deployments in the U.S., South Korea, Japan, and China. It's going to be sooner than they expected a year ago. It's accelerated by almost a year. As for the U.S., there's no specific date. The release dates differ for every carrier, so that's something that we still have to just wait for them to give us that information.
How much will it cost?
So there's no way to tell quite yet, but it shouldn't be too much of an increase from the current 4G cost. Both Nokia and another company agreed that 5G can't cost too much more than what consumers are paying for 4G right now. It's too early to say what the exact cost will be, but it shouldn't be too much of an increase.
Are there any drawbacks with 5G?
So one of the challenges with higher frequency signals is that they don't travel as far as lower frequencies, so multiple inputs and outputs antennas will be needed to use to boost and multiply signals anywhere that 5G is offered. For Global Media News, I'm Marcy Mendonca. Back to you, James.
Thanks, Marcy. Let's go social. Up next, we have a report on celebrity death threats on social media.
My co-host, James Martizoni, is on the celebrity social media. He has been following the news about celebrities getting threatening tweets and even death threats on their social media accounts. James, is this a problem, a common problem for celebrities? What kinds of celebrities are we talking about right now? What are they doing about it, and what are the platforms doing to confront all this trolling and abuse?
Well, it is actually a very common problem for celebrities. I feel like anything that the celebrities do, they actually receive, like, death threats. It can be something very small, as in, like, dating someone. It can be something that a person doesn't support, but meanwhile, they actually support. What are they doing about it, actually? They're trying to really block all the hate these celebrities, they just don't want it on their feed, on their timeline, on their mentions, and everything. And, like, what kind of celebrities are we talking about here? It could be really, like, anyone. It could be an A-lister, B-lister, C-lister. Like, it could be even someone just like us. It doesn't have to actually be a celebrity. But most of the time, they are targeted, and mostly it's by, like, a lot of people. Like, there are people, like, actually, like, Kim Kardashian that received death threats after she tweeted her support of Israel. She got tweets saying, like, oh, I'll pray you will die, Kim, and kill yourself and die in hell. These are just some of the few, like, threatening, like, messages that she actually, like, received. There was even times where, like, Selena Gomez, she received a lot of death threats from a lot of Justin Bieber fans when she started dating Justin Bieber. And just fans just went totally crazy because they're kind of jealous because, you know, like, they want to date Justin Bieber and he was a teen heartthrob years ago, so. And, like, sometimes it can even go to the extreme being, like, Halle Berry, like, said that she was, like, moving to France once because she was receiving a death threat from a man saying that, like, the man was going to slit her throat. Like, it can be all kind of things, like, so. And what are the platforms going to do about all of this? They're really trying to, like, disable their accounts because it's also a violation of Twitter rules to do something like that, anything abusive, harmful, or anything that will, like, make a person want to, like, you know, like, abuse someone. So it's just very wrong.
Who was the most recent celebrity that received death threats?
Well, the most recent celebrity that received death threats was actually Cardi B. She actually posted a photo of herself on social media, on technically Instagram. She was wearing a blue fur coat from the Super Bowl with the caption, "I hate wearing blue, but this coat was too poppin'." Her word of blue got people, like, very wound up, and, like, people just didn't like it. And it's, like, apparently, like, a diss to the Chris, like, which is a gang, their favorite color, blue. But she actually she didn't take any effect to it. Like, she lives for this. Like, you know, she jumped back and just ignored it a little bit. Like, she even posted, like, a little thing about it on, like, on her Instagram as well. Like, she was seen out in Los Angeles. Like, they told her, like, not to come to L.A. Meanwhile, like, she went to L.A., did her thing, like, didn't let her stop it. And also another one was actually Kathy Griffin. And she actually took part in a shoot with, like, a photographer where she posed with a bloody, like, decapitated head resembling Donald Trump. And that wound up getting a lot of hate. That actually happened last year, but she did an interview about a month or two ago, and she still said that she still receives, like, death threats to this day about the photo that she posted, and since then it was deleted because she mostly got a lot of hate from a lot of Trump supporters.
It's very interesting to see the impact of social media and just threats from people. Do you think celebrities post too much about their whereabouts?
They actually do post a lot about their whereabouts. I feel like there are a lot of celebrities who are pretty smart about it because, you know, anyone can just come to a place technically to, like, a mall that they're at, like, if they see something on, like, Snapchat or Instagram, and, you know, like, they're, like, it's that moment, so they will, so these people can come, and since, like, if they get a death threat and, like, they're actually serious about it, like, they will try to find these celebrities, and these celebrities sometimes just post where they are, if they're going to a restaurant, someone can match it up or know that restaurant. Or if they're close by, going to an event or something, they will totally do something about it. Like, there are some people, like the Kardashians, for example, like, they actually post on Snapchat, but they don't really post their whereabouts too much anymore. They either post it when they leave, like, they put their phone in airplane mode, and then they won't post until they actually go to the airplane mode. For Global Media News, I am James Arizona, back to you.
Thanks, James. Let's stick with Trump. Many accounts on social media are created by automated bots. Twitter has a big problem with this. Greg Mundell is following this story. Right, just how big a problem is this? How many Twitter accounts are fake? And what is Twitter doing to stop the bots?
Well, Twitter's had a problem with bots for a very long time now, essentially since apps and programs were developed to send out tweets and, like, badges. Basically, what they do is they take a bunch of accounts that often have, like, automated names. You see, like, just a Twitter Abby that'll be just an egg or something. And they'll just be a bunch of numbers and a random name. And what they're being used to do in bulk is send out these messages by, you know, in the news lately, it's been, you know, offered up that it might be Russia doing this, but it really could just be anybody with these designs to kind of just spin any message they want to. It's a lot of propaganda, basically. So, what Twitter's been doing, because they don't really want their service to be used this way, you know, to be swaying large, you know, global political arguments just because somebody has the ability to, they don't want their name on that. So, what they basically did was change their API, which is their application program interface, which is essentially a set of routines, protocols, and tools that really set guidelines for how they allow software to be built on their own platform. And what they've done with that is made it so that you can't have these services send out batch tweets just for, you know, whatever information you want. All the developers have until the 23rd of March to do something about it, but in the meantime, what they did was last Wednesday, they locked out, although they haven't been saying this, a few prominent conservative accounts or whatever. And while they did that overnight, they purged a ton of these followers they considered to be bots or whatever. And what this has done is kind of really inflamed conservatives, really, like, a ton. They've been blaming Twitter for censorship and stuff like that. Kind of just, you know, unfair, being treated unfairly.
What will bots still be used for?
Bots will still be used for, what do you call it, public service announcements or any emergency weather services, you know, updates like that, like new stuff. But, you know, it has to be on an official basis. It can't just be, you know, some sitting at home, it's just a program open allowing him to send out tweets from 50 accounts, 1,000 accounts, whatever the number is. They just really don't want anybody to have the ability to do that. And at least, you know, they need to have some type of, they need to be watching these people. It needs to be something that they're allowing them to do specifically for them.
Yeah, for sure. Especially with just the extent of the culture of the groups. Have any prominent conservatives spoken out to them?
Yeah, there's been a few. I mean, probably the most well-known is Richard Spencer. He's a big alt-right leader. Then some others have been Michael Flynn Jr., Cassandra Fairbanks, who's a journalist, and Paul Joseph Watson. He's an InfoWars editor. And these have been the kinds of people that have been really, preaching against Twitter at the moment, complaining that they've been, censoring them or whatever. They've actually tried to get conservatives to boycott Twitter using the hashtag Twitter lockout. But again, this is just another one of their agendas.
Well, was it a good move? Do you think Christ better to explain their reasoning behind purging bots?
A lot of people that work for Twitter, I mean, not exactly using their name or whatever, have been kind of speaking out on maybe they shouldn't have gone out and explicitly said the types of accounts that they're trying to get rid of and the reason why and all the protocols for developers to adhere to by the 23rd. They shouldn't have made that as public of knowledge as they did, because that's going to give hackers kind of like a quick lane to just get back to it. Or just, find a way to subvert what they're trying to do now and just do the same thing. For Global Media News, I'm Greg Mandel. Back to you again.
Thanks, Will. We'll be right back with some YouTube news and a report about social media and racial injustice.
Joe Simon is our YouTube reporter, and he has noticed that YouTube has a conspiracy video problem. Joe, what is a conspiracy video, and can you give us some examples, and what can YouTube do about these viral videos spreading the conspiracy theories? Should platforms be censoring content, and doesn't that raise issues of censorship?
Thank you, James. Conspiracy video, more or less, is a video talking about or explaining some sort of situation where there's a lot of controversy around it, either differing opinions, or it was a major event, something like 9/11, where there's a lot of different opinions on it. So a conspiracy video is basically explaining a usually not quite very popular idea and trying to promote it and make it more accessible to other people. That's been an issue for YouTube lately, because there's a lot of, this year and last year, there are a lot of, big, bold headline stuff that, like the Parkland shooting a couple weeks back. Big events like that more or less stir up that side of YouTube and make it more active. Now, some of it is purely just in their own way trying to educate people on things that people are passionate about. But a lot of it is just taking advantage of YouTube's algorithms, the way that YouTube works to push popular videos to the front of the site, thus generating more viewership and more viewership, and as well as more money from ad revenue. It's giving these videos a lot more attention. There's been a lot of videos, an influx of videos recently, talking about and accusing one of the Parkland school survivors of being a crisis actor. That's not just a YouTube thing. That's in the press as well, the mainstream, newspaper press and whatnot. But it's created a big influx of conspiracy videos at the front of YouTube. A lot of people are seeing them. A lot of people are reacting to them, and it's just one more issue for YouTube to have to deal with right now. There was a piece by CNBC, they asked a professor for, I think, New York University about how YouTube's algorithms work. He spent time running through basically rabbit holes of conspiracy videos where he would let the up next tab run and just play whatever is suggested or similar to what he was watching. And it basically just kept building. And the videos got weirder and stranger and just very differently from all of these different angles of different topics. And he said that all of this is just generating ad revenue for the people who are running these channels, and as well as spreading false information in some cases.
What are some of these high-profile artists or content producers that are making these conspiracy videos?
I don't have most of those, purely because a lot of them are just getting taken down. YouTube is finally starting to wisen up, and they're keeping an eye on these kind of videos, and I believe that they have people working on tracking these kind of these creators and whatnot to shut down the stream of videos. It's never going to go away. There's no way that YouTube can forever get rid of conspiracy videos. It's just not possible with the Parkland situation, because that is the main one at the moment. It'd be nice if they were able to settle that and, you know, finish that up, get those videos off so that that situation can be handled, you know, properly with real information. Then, on the other side of it, their former poster child turned fallen angel, now same thing again, Logan Paul is back in the limelight for YouTube. They recently announced that some of his ad revenue is getting returned. He's still on some sort of probation. It's not very clear, at least from everything I've been reading, about what exactly he's being punished with at the moment. But he's back because it's a YouTuber in Britain, KSI. I've never heard of him outside of these articles. Apparently, he challenged Logan Paul to a boxing match in response to all of this controversy Paul stirred up. And Logan Paul accepted. Based on the last match that KSI had, he fought Joe Weller in Queen Elizabeth Olympic Park in London. It was comparable, viewership-wise, it was comparable to the Floyd versus Mayweather fight for YouTube. It brought in a lot of revenue for advertisers for YouTube itself, a lot of attention from major news outlets. People were paying attention, and now this fight is gearing up to be even bigger than that. So, the problem there is, while YouTube's trying to tackle this conspiracy theory thing, they're now basically using that as a cover to go back on everything they said about Logan Paul trying to punish him and other YouTubers from doing things that he did. And now they're banking on him for making them all of this attention and revenue, and it seems like it's going back to the way it is. Really hoping it's not, but it's still a developing situation, so there's not anything else I could say. The fight, no matter what, is going to be huge. There's no way it won't be a massive success for YouTube. Too many people will be watching it. It is what it is, but hopefully they wise up.
For sure. It's interesting you mentioned KSI. I remember you from Facebook YouTube.
That's what it was. I don't watch that kind of content.
Oh, good. Understandable. Do you think that even though YouTube's starting to do things about it, do you think they're doing enough?
Definitely not. It's a little unfair because it is a lot of work policing. Having humans, not bots, policing their servers is a lot of work. It's a lot of money that's going to be spent hiring new people and training new people. But it's necessary, and they're starting to show that they have a sense of what's going on and what they should be doing. And I'm hoping that that continues. I hope that they keep learning from this and they don't just ignore it and go back to the way it was. Logan Paul being poster child for all of YouTube and everything's great and he just does whatever he wants. And that just inspires more people to do the same thing. So I don't know. I really don't know if they're doing enough. I'm just watching.
Understandable. Do you think that these conspiracy videos are possibly doing emotional damage or hurting people that might have been involved in these incidents?
The one in particular, I don't remember his name offhand. The one in particular who's been the focus. He's been giving interviews about it. He's not, you know, crying about it. He's not, at least in the interviews, he's not crying about it. He's not saying how unfair it is. He's saying this is a distraction from the main issue, and he's sticking to his point and saying what he needs to say. And it's actually, it's very admirable for someone that age. But the conspiracy videos are, I think, just a distraction at the end of the day. It's just misinformation that doesn't need to be out there, and it's just deflecting from the main issue. Hopefully this resolves itself soon. For Global Media News, I'm Joe Freiman. Back to you.
Thanks, Joe. Asher Forster has been thinking about the effect that all of this fake news and wild content on social media and the internet has been having on racial and social injustice. She wrote a post that discussed a publicity stunt in social injustice. Asha, what do you mean by a publicity stunt in social injustice in this context? What is the new media angle?
So I basically found this topic very interesting because we live in such like a complex world now where there are so many new technological innovations and basically everything is moving us closer to a society that's controlled by like scrutiny, you know, automation and prediction. So a lot of social injustice, specifically meaning like via social media, in this case on Twitter, has occurred like on behalf of this issue. So unfortunately, like this is taking place at the same time where the world is undergoing like a lot of transformations in regards to like, culture and demographic and political aspects. I've actually found it interesting. There was an article that the Ford Foundation had written, and it said that in 2016 and 2017, there was a rapid rise in the number of reported hate crimes that targeted not only Muslims, but the LGBTQ community, as well as immigrants and also groups that were trying to protect and strengthen racial injustice. And interestingly enough, in 2016, the election was basically like littered with the use of intelligent Twitter bots, which were aimed at manipulating search engines and advertisements to prevent users from viewing specific news on certain platforms, and there were also algorithms and like filter bubbles that have been blamed for the inaccuracy and separating basically fiction from real news. And then there was also an article by Independent News that reported online racist trolls making false claims that the members of basically like the white population that were being attacked at the screening of the new Black Panther movie. And there was a picture that was going viral on Twitter where a girl had a bloodied face and she was making, you know, allegations saying that she had a bottle thrown at her at the screening of the Black Panther. And basically people were just attempting to, you know, they had ill intent and they were trying to cause hatred through social media by falsely claiming that they've been attacked by, you know, Black, you know, cinema goers essentially because they were white. That's what they were turning it into. And it wasn't until Twitter, like people on Twitter started, you know, basically they figured out that she was lying and that their statements were really debunked and their Twitter accounts were actually suspended. And I just think that's so crazy how, yeah, we see so many different things on social media, and it's so easy to really believe anything, you know? Like, what is, like, if someone said they were hit by something, you know, a bottle or essentially, especially now in these days, 2018, where it's such a touchy subject, you know, race is a touchy subject. when you make an allegation like this, it's very serious.
I actually remember seeing that tweet, and then I was like looking through the comments, and like apparently everybody was like, "Oh, this picture was actually from like a long time ago. It's not like how they say it actually happened," and everything. I was just like reading through the comments and everything, and like apparently like, everyone was so mad.
Yeah.
But do you think the use of propaganda and misinformation is increasing in the tech world?
Absolutely. And you can use, like, whatever information that you have access to, I guess, to push your own personal agenda. That really goes for anybody. You know, it's easy to start in an uproar, you know, especially with a hot topic such as this. It's easy to get, you know, a snowball effect and have people jumping on the bandwagon with something like that.
Do you know of any companies that have spoken up about pushing justice in the media?
Yes, actually, I know that the CEOs of GoDaddy and Airbnb, they canceled the accounts of racist organizers and instigators, which actually opens up an interesting conversation because, you know, there are companies that that basically there's a trend. I shouldn't say a trend, but there's basically executives, if they speak up on a social injustice, you know, issue, it's called executive activism. And so I feel like it opens up an interesting topic for executives to get more involved in the conversation and, you know, basically have a say-so in, you know, what's right, essentially.
But do you think that tech CEOs are getting involved in activism, like, with this topic? And, like, do you think it's, like, an effective, like, idea?
Yeah, I absolutely do think it's an effective idea because there's actually a report that says that the majority of millennials, 56%, expect CEOs and other companies, other executives to step forward on social issues more than they have in the past versus just 35% of baby boomers. You know, and really contrary to belief, it's actually beneficial for CEOs to get involved in the conversation because it's actually good for their business as well. People like to see major corporations, companies, you know, speaking up for what's right. So it definitely brings, it's definitely good for business. It's mutually beneficial. You know, they speak up for what's right, and also it's good for their business as well. For Global Media News, I'm Aisha Foster. Back to you, James.
Thanks, Aisha, and thanks to Miguel Castro for hosting with me this week. Many thanks to Ricardo Morales and Pizza Mind Blundy for producing our show. Today, we heard reports from Kristen Brave, Miguel Castro, Marissa Evola, Aisha Foster, Joseph Ryman, James Arzoni, Greg Mandel, and Marcy Mendonca.
Global Media News is brought to you by CoWMWI, Northwestern, and the Media Communications Department here at the State University of New York College at Northwestern.
For more media news and resources, check out our latest post on the Catalyst at oldwestburycatalyst.org. where you can listen to all of our webcasts and even subscribe to our podcast.
Follow us on Twitter at OWWRGMA. Use our Twitter feed to keep up with the latest news for aspiring journalists and media professionals. That's at OWWRGMA. I'm going to go to the next one.